you so very much,
Cecilia.
Having been in India, one knows only this greeting after a while, and it comes very natural. And thank you, Neil. And my dear fellow members and friends here in New Zealand, I'm so very happy that I could come for a few days. I deeply regretted last year having to cable at the last moment that I could not be with you at Massey University, but the Australian section had planned such a very full, I guess I should say, schedule. I'm trying to remember that when I get back to the United States to say schedule once again. but such a very full program for me that I found even the time to come over for at least a little of your convention was just not possible, and I ask you to forgive me. I must say New Zealand holds a very special place in my heart, and I'm happy to be back again. I think it's not only the most beautiful country, but a country where the society is so very vital and alive that it is thrilling to come here. I bring you, of course, first of all, the warm and affectionate greetings of ADYAR and all of the workers there, and most particularly, of course, of our president, John Coates. Many of you know that he has recently undergone surgery. He is recovering quite satisfactorily. It has slowed him down only temporarily. As the doctor says, he is having what may be called the usual normal complications. But he is recovering, and in due time will, of course, resume his very active program of touring and getting about among sections. Meanwhile, I have escaped for a little while to return to my homeland and happily was able to come through here. For so many years, I think we all looked forward to that event known as our centenary, the 100th anniversary of the society. And that now is history. Very vivid and very beautiful history for all of us who participated in any or all of the programs. It was my privilege, of course, to participate very actively in all of the programs around the world, that is, the major programs planned internationally, beginning with New York, and then London, Bombay, ADYAR, and then the Indo-Pacific Conference in Kuala Lumpur, and then concluded with the Australian Convention and the centenary meetings there. What emerged inevitably, and what we expected would emerge, is the fact that we are a strong and united society, that the movement is well and healthy. And as one lives and works at ADYAR, one gains a certain view, a certain perspective from that world center. One looks out and one inevitably sees that while in some areas of the world the work goes forward with some difficulty, and some areas of the world there seems to be a movement almost in reverse of some setbacks, that in other areas of the world the work goes forward, strong and healthy. And I think that our concern now that we have entered into the second century, we have held the 101st convention now at ADYAR, we're in the 102nd year, that we begin to feel, at least intuitively, what must be the impetus, the spiritual opportunity that is before us. Perhaps not with a great fanfare, perhaps not announced with trumpets and drums and all of the rest, but quietly emerging, quietly coming in, a new vision of wholeness, a new awareness of the unitary nature of life, a new breakthrough, quietly, in the realization of what it is to be human today. It is true that for such a vision to come about, change is necessary in human thinking, in the total consciousness of mankind. And if we are alert to this, if we are aware of it, I think we can begin to witness very delicately, very subtly perhaps, but begin to witness the birth of the new out of what seems to be the chaos that is all about us. I am one who is convinced that it may become more difficult, not easier, but more difficult to perceive the true in the welter of the pseudo and of the false and ungenuine remarks and interests about us. It may become more difficult to pick out the real gems of the occult tradition. We may feel that it ought to be more simple, it ought to be simpler and easier to discover. But I think we are really up against a very real challenge, a challenge when we are going to have to move to what I call the center of ourselves, so that as one views the world society from that world center, which is Adyar, so there is, if I may put it this way, in each one of us a certain Adyar of the spirit to which we must move in order to perceive as clearly as possible what is going on in the world. In a sense, I think this is the situation which is revealed in the Bhagavad Gita, in the very first chapter. Now, most times if one studies the Gita, and it's a book that is universally known, of course, and studied, I think, by theosophists everywhere, one leaps over the first chapter. One feels that, after all, that's just introductory and full of a lot of Hindu names that one can scarcely, if one is a Westerner, one has a certain difficulty pronouncing, and so one skips that over. And perhaps as Westerners, we are a bit impatient, and we are accustomed to the fact that the real denouement of the story occurs in the last chapter. So many of us read the last chapter first, and we think we have the essence of it, you know. We know the whole story. And if we don't do that, we think, well, if we begin about the middle of it, we'll at least get the core of it. We'll get the heart of it. But I would like to propose that the real essence of it is in the first chapter, because it sets the stage. It sets a necessary condition which must arise, which must come about, if one is to discover the answers, a condition in which Arjuna, who represents obviously every man, a man with a problem, which is all of us, because that's all Arjuna was, a man with a problem. And most of us are people with problems, isn't that right? Problems of some sort or another. Arjuna was a man with a problem. And in that sense, he is timeless man and represents the whole human condition. But unlike many of us when we have problems, Arjuna recognized where he was. This is the first requirement, to recognize where we are in life. To digress for a moment, there is a wonderful story in the Hasidic tradition of the lore of the Judaic tradition, Eastern European Jewry, the mystical Judaic tradition, which tells of a rabbi, a tzaddik, a holy man, who was imprisoned in northern Russia for his beliefs. And while he was in prison, his guards taunted him with various questions concerning his beliefs. And on one occasion, the guard came to him and said, "You say that your God is all-knowing. Your God can look out and is omniscient, knows what man is doing at every moment. How was it then that your God did not know where Adam was after Adam had eaten of the fruit of the tree of good and evil, of knowledge, and so cried out into the garden, 'Adam, where art thou?'" Do you remember this is there in the scripture? "Adam, where art thou?" Why would a God who is all-knowing make such a cry? But the rabbi answered, "Because God calls to man at every moment of history, at all times, not because God does not know where man is, but because he must awaken man to know where he is himself. And so it is, to put it in modern terms, a kind of psychological shock treatment. That at all times there is that calling to us, 'Adam, where art thou?' And the response comes only from those who are awake, who first of all know what they're about. And so Adam answered, 'I hid myself.' Which is simply to say, I tried to escape from my human condition. Now Arjuna, in the same situation, in the timeless human condition which represents each one of us, in an age in which there is so much turmoil, in which occultism seems to be flowering, and yet in which there is so much of the pseudo and the false and the misleading, so that we are led down one garden path after another and forget the real, true, genuine, spiritual truth which has been given to us, of which we today are the heirs in the Theosophical Society. But Arjuna recognized where he was, and so he called out. He had Sri Krishna, his divine teacher, take his chariot to the center between the two opposing armies. He did not stay on one side and look across the field to see the other army, as it were. He detached himself and went to the center, and there he called to Sri Krishna, "Stay my chariot, O Achyutya." And in that phrase, I think, we have the sine qua non, the absolute essential condition for a true understanding. That each one of us, and this, I think, is the challenge now clearly before us in this final quarter of the 20th century, to get into the center where there is that calm, quiet stillness from which we can observe both armies, the pairs of opposites, the entire conflict, all of the movements that are going on. The ancient Chinese, you know, it is said that they could pronounce no greater imprecation on an individual than, "I curse you to live in an age of change." Well, if that be so, we are all cursed. And this 20th century existence incarnation may be the most cursed of all incarnations. But perhaps the curse is really the opportunity and privilege for the greatest growth, for the greatest unfoldment. The normal patterns to which we have been accustomed are being broken up. And so I think it is for each of us to say, to move out into the center and there say to that divinity within, "Stay my chariot. so that we can survey the field. We can look at all of the opposing forces and all of the movements around us and begin to get a view from the center. This is what we supremely need, to come to the center and there begin our quest for understanding. In religion and in psychology, the ancient symbol of the mandala has often been used. And today there is a tremendous interest, particularly among young people, in mandalas, in the mandala symbol. In Tibetan Buddhism, the mandala is said to assist meditation and concentration. It is, of course, a very simple circular figure, always with a center. In fact, the word mandala in Sanskrit means both circle and center, the dual meaning. In many religious observances, mandalas are drawn, painted, modeled, and even danced. And as psychological phenomena today, mandalas often appear spontaneously in dreams. Dr. Carl Jung, for example, the great Swiss psychologist, tells of his own discovery of the meaning of the mandala. And in his autobiographical work on memories, dreams, and reflections, he says that he sketched each day a small circular drawing, a mandala, which seemed to correspond with his own inner situation, until suddenly he discovered, as he says, what the mandala really is: formation, transformation, eternal minds, eternal recreation. And that, continued Jung, is the self, the wholeness, which, if all goes well, is harmonious. The self was like the monad which I am and which is my world. It was, of course, the discovery of the mandala that became the key to Jung's own further adventures in consciousness and the development of his entire system of the path to the center, which is the whole point of Jungian psychology, for example, is taking the path to the center, a road which he called individuation. It is the same path, the age-old path, which is revealed in all the great scriptures and religious books of all the great systems of the world. The mandala, it may be suggested, is an archetype then, an archetype representative of this movement to the center, from where alone we can view what is going on in the world about us. It is the path that it seems to me it is essential that we must take today. It is not a path of glory, of great fanfare. It's not a path that is going to bring us in more and more into public attention, perhaps. But it is, I think, the path that is indicated by the work the Theosophical Society must undertake in this final quarter of the 20th century. In a sense, it was the path that we took outwardly in connection with the centenary, the rediscovery of the center of the society's purpose, a rediscovery of what the society was all about at its inception. What was its purpose? What was its central objective? And a reestablishment of ourselves in that center. And now it seems to me that it is still the path that we each have to take individually, that we each have to discover for ourselves, if the society, and most of all theosophy, is to remain a vital force in the world today. I have been thinking, for example, and this may seem heretical to you, but if it be heresy, then it is heresy. The Theosophical Society cannot long endure without theosophy, but theosophy will always endure whether there be a society or not. And what is important then is that we find that central point of contact with the essence of theosophy, of that expanding wisdom which is present. Theosophy, we frequently say, comes from the two Greek words, theos and sophia. Theos meaning God. Theos, I would remind you, does not really mean God or the divine. It's very interesting. It comes from the Greek word theon. It's a verb which means to move and to grow. Just as the Brahma Vidya, which is the Sanskrit term for the ageless wisdom, Vidya as knowledge, as seeing, as pure perception, a consciousness of pure understanding and perception, arises out of a condition, Brahma, which comes from the Sanskrit root bri, a verb which means to expand, to grow. Because both in the Greek and in the Sanskrit, there is the same concept of a wisdom that grows from a central seed, a central point. And this, again, is discovering the view from the center. And so it seems to me that we must discover, if we can, what is the center of our own being, and then move out to the circumference. We draw our own circles. This concept, for example, of the mandala as an archetype present within, one can say in the beginning was the center. The center is symbolic then of the eternal potential which expands, which grows, which develops in a new way, in new directions. We can see that there is on all sides today a need to reconstruct the primal unity of humanity, of knowledge, of understanding. We can note, for example, just in passing, the absorbing interest today in astrology, which I think is evidence for the reappearance of the archetype of wholeness, because every birth chart, for example, from an astrological point of view, every birth chart is the mandala of an individual life. And it's from the center that one moves out, as it were. So the goal is always the movement to the center, and then from the center to the circumference. Now the magic of the mandala as process lies always in the recognition that whatever lies in the quaternity of the circumference leads towards the center, because the fundamental form of the mandala is simply the cross, the quaternity of the circumference, the simple division into four. And I think that this can easily be pointed out as we look at, for example, the works of our great founder, H.P. Blavatsky. In other words, I'd like to apply for a moment the mandala technique, if I can call it that, to the realization of what is our task today in terms of those universals proposed by H.P. Blavatsky, through whom the wisdom of that unfoldment of divinity, through whom the ancient mysteries, the occult tradition, was imparted to our modern world. HPB is more modern today than she was 100 years ago, and her writings are more relevant today than they were then, if that is at all possible. Because what she revealed was an ageless truth, principles, which can be applied at every point. And so It seems to me if one looks at the four major works which she gave to the world, which were given through her, a re-impression, as it were, into human consciousness on a scale never known before, of truths which up to that time had been communicated only in mystery schools and ashrams and hidden retreats, and passed on by the oral tradition of the Guru Parampara, the oral tradition of mouth to ear, now for the first time made public and given as tools into our hands to apply at every point, at every moment of time, and in the here and now of our present mundane existence. Because here we have, in these four major works, a mandala of universal principles at whose center is the radiant light of the immortal self shining through the self of each unit of life, enabling us to contact that self. The quaternity of works, in other words, on the circumference of our mandala, is certainly well known to all theosophical students. Isis Unveiled, whose 100th anniversary of its publication we celebrate this year in 1977. It was published in 1877, 2 years after the Society's founding, and the first printing sold out in 10 days. So this is the anniversary, the centenary, of the first keynote of the work that leads to the center, from which one can have a view of all life, all existence, in a new and creative way. Isis Unveiled, the secret doctrine, the key to theosophy, the voice of the silence. The very names of the four works strike a receptive note within us, and each leads to that center from which we can gain a true view of all life and its activities. So Isis Unveiled, published, as I say, just 100 years ago this year. This work shattered the rigid orthodoxies of the 19th century. Its two volumes, one on science and the other on religion, were quite literally mental atomic bombs that exploded in the consciousness of that time, nearly blinding all who came within their orbit. They pointed the way to a new freedom, a freedom of the mind from religious dogmatism and scientific materialism. And this then was the first universal principle revealed in the first segment of our quaternity, freedom. Interestingly, it came not more than a decade, a little over a decade, after the Civil War in the United States had established the principle of physical freedom, of freedom from slavery in physical activity. Physical freedom had to be achieved first. And it is interesting that Isis Unveiled should be published in the United States, as the society was founded there, in a country which had seen the first major struggle in modern times for freedom from physical bondage. But that kind of freedom is not sufficient. Mental freedom, the freedom of the monastic principle, had to be enunciated, and it is still not fully realized even by those of us who feel we are participants in this ageless wisdom tradition. Freedom of the mind, a monastic freedom that is not attached in any way to anything. The essential work which had to be done, which is pointed out later, is the shift of manas, the mind, from its attachment to kama, the desires, to buddhi, the propelling force of love and compassion. A remarkable change which is still taking place. But this was the great principle enunciated, the all-important freedom of the mind. The society enunciates it, but how free are we? How free are any of us mentally? We always look at things from whatever side we happen to be on, because we haven't moved to the center and there said, "Stay my chariot. I will stand here and survey all of the scene." But the enunciation of that principle was there, and there it is in the first segment of our quaternity. Then 11 years later, and students of numerology will see, I'm sure, a symbology in that number, 11 years later, appeared the second major work of HPB. The mind had been set free, at least it had been enunciated as an absolute essential that the mind must be free from attachment. Now fundamental propositions must be set forth. The mind free must now be able to look at universals. It must now be awakened, consciousness awakened to a perception of the orderliness of cosmic and microcosmic processes. And so in the secret doctrine, the great processes and principles of cosmogenesis are set forth. Principles unvarying in their operation, universal in their application, repeated, replicated magnificently in the whole evolutionary process of man himself, complex in their manifold permutations, and yet in their essentiality, really unique, simple, singular, uncompounded. At heart, threefold, one universal root substance, a single unitary source about which nothing can be said, for it is beyond all the play of the opposites. A universal law of periodicity, cyclic unfoldment, the in-breathing and out-breathing of universal process. And finally, the fundamental identity of each unit of life with the whole in which it is embedded. The triplicity of the orderliness of the universe. And so out of freedom arises order, which is lawfulness, whose fundamental expression is in the concept that all life, all process unfolds, emerges from within outwards. And so here we have the two segments of our quaternity, the first two segments, freedom, order. Then two minor cycles of 7 years passed since the founding of the society in 1875. The first two parts of the quadrant have now appeared, and in the 14th year of the society's existence were to appear the final two parts of the quaternity. These numbers, I think, are not without significance. In the 14th year of the society's existence, two minor cycles of 7 years, the society well established, safe, as it were, launched, past the first great reefs and shoals of disaster that might have wrecked it and that threatened to wreck it. And now, out on the high seas, as it were, freedom and order are now united with the principles of one hand, universality, and on the other, inner illumination, enlightenment. The publication of The Key to Theosophy in 1889 sounded the note of the universal applicability of universal principles to all aspects of human life. A comprehensive and systematic presentation of the lofty ideas, first principles, enunciated and set forth in the secret doctrine, is now given in The Key to Theosophy. And the interesting thing is that only 14 years after the society's birth is the word theosophy used in the title of a book. For the first time, the word theosophy appears in the title of a book. 14 years after the society was established. These laws, the principles set forth in the secret doctrine, based on the freedom established in Isis, undergirding both microcosmic and macrocosmic systems, are universally applicable. In religion, in ethics, in science, in education, in every field of human life, in codes of behavior, these universal principles may be seen at work. The key to our mandala is in personal effort, personal application. The recognition that theosophy must be encountered by each of us and then spread, made applicable, put to work. To know is not enough. One must act on what one knows. As the Pseudo-Dionysius put it, one must not only learn the truth, one must suffer it. Now we must bear the burden of our knowledge. We must fulfill the responsibility of having encountered the universal ideas and principles. It is not enough to have established freedom within the mind, to have brought the mind into a condition of freedom. It is not enough to have recognized the orderliness of universal process. We must now act in accordance with our knowledge, but that action must be universal in nature. For when action is universal in nature, when it arises out of a recognition of universality, it is altruism. And so H.P.B. pointed out in articles which she wrote in Lucifer, her magazine in London, that he who practices theosophy, altruism, finds that it throws him who practices it out of calculation of the ranks of the living altogether. So here we have three aspects of our quadrant on the circumference of our mandala, each related to the other in a most beautiful and harmonious and mysterious way. Principle of freedom, by which the mind is released from the bonds of the past. The principle of order, the lawfulness that appears apparent everywhere, by which all universal process emerges. And now the principle of universality, which is altruism, by which action becomes whole and complete. Altruism, which is brotherhood in action. Brotherhood with understanding. Brotherhood derived from a deep eternal source, from the center. But a fourth principle is required to complete our mandala, to lead us to the true center, which is ultimately one with the circumference, which reveals that there is neither center nor circumference as two distinct elements. For mandala, as I said earlier, means both center and circle, both center and circumference. And the fourth aspect of our quaternity reveals this most beautifully. And it is represented in the sequence of the major works given us by H.P.B. in her final gift to the world, The Voice of the Silence. Dedicated to the few, she wrote, this work, as she said, was for the few real mystics in the Theosophical Society. For the few real mystics. For it revealed the path that leads to illumination, the solitary path of the bodhisattva, not the path of the multitude, but the path of the bodhisattva, he whose very being, sat, he whose very essence is bodhi, compassion, wisdom. Wisdom, compassion, love in action. Knowing freedom, He is voluntarily bound to all things. Recognizing order and the lawfulness of universal process, he lives in harmony with all. Realizing the profound truth of universality, he acts at every moment for the welfare of all. His very presence in the world, his very presence among the multitude, brings wisdom, enlightenment, peace, and understanding. For he recognizes finally and knows, as the voice has put it, compassion is no attribute. It is the law of laws, eternal harmony, Alaya's self, a shoreless universal essence, the light of everlasting right, the fitness of all things, the law of love eternal. The more thou dost become at one with it, thy being melted in its being, the more thy soul unites with that which is, the more thou wilt become compassion absolute. So here, I feel, fellow members, is our task, a never-ending task. The centenary did not end it, it began it. Our work is just beginning, because our work is on ourselves, to shape the rough ashlars of our being into the perfect stone that will fit into the guardian wall of humanity, wedged as countless other stones, as the voice of the silence puts it. There to hold back the tides that would engulf humanity in darkness once again. That wisdom tradition alive, not because our books are there and we go on publishing books. The wisdom tradition alive, not because we have buildings and lodges and speakers and presidents and vice presidents and heaven only knows what all. Not because we lecture at and with and to and for each other and the world. The wisdom tradition alive because we are in the world. We stand at the center. We view all things from the center. We have had our chariot move to the center of the Kurukshetra of today, the field of battle, and there we stay, my chariot. Stand firm while all about us swirls and eddies, while all the pseudo-occult, the schools of yoga and the ashrams and retreats of Hare Krishna and Sai Baba and everything else goes on. Each having perhaps something of the truthfulness, but the wisdom tradition pure, because we are in the world. Here is the mandala of our work, which can work within us, an archetype of wholeness leading to that center within, which is reflected in every outer center in the world. Reflected at Adyar, reflected wherever there is a lodge, reflected in every center of the work throughout the world, and every member a center. Every center there a member. The quaternity of process, freedom, order, universality, illumination. And so at the center, light. Only light, which is also love. And in that illumination, both center and circumference merge. It is a center which is everywhere with its circumference nowhere. No longer necessary to move on the circumference of our mandala, further fragmenting the quaternity. We can live in and at the center, become the center, our lives fully centered lives. And if sometimes the vision fails, because it will, sometimes our steps falter and we are knocked off center, we say, we may learn even out on the circumference that we must Have patience, candidate, as one who fears no failure, courts no success. Fix thy soul's gaze upon the star whose ray thou art, the flaming star that shines within the lightless depths of ever-being, the boundless fields of the unknown. And if that center sometimes seems distant from where you are, have perseverance as one who doth forevermore endure. For we may remember there are those greater than we who stand at the center. There are those who forever stand at the center of the universe itself, in the center of every crowd, in the center of all humanity, in the center of our being. There are those great ones whose society this still is, my brothers. And they see not in time, not in the little segments of time of 100 years, or the final quarter, or into the next century, but in terms of thousands of years, of ages, for the wisdom goes on. But it is our privilege at this time, now, here, to be centered and to be centers. And it is in this way that Theosophy will never leave the Theosophical Society. And I hope the Theosophical Society will never leave Theosophy.